In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
On the surface, the idea of a Torontonian not being able to visit their cottage over the Victoria Day long weekend is the stereotype of privilege. Poor baby. No May 2-4 bender on the dock for you. Meanwhile, the rest of us are stuck here just trying to survive. And it's true. There is a lucky 0.1% who can drive up the highway to cottages on the lake that look like mansions. But that is just the tip of what we refer to as cottage country, or going to the cottage, or up to the cabin. Cottages can be old family properties, still decorated like the 1970s, that serve as a break from a 500-square-foot apartment. Cottages can be RVs parked on a lot by a beach. They can be tiny bunkies built by hand with just enough room for an overnight camper. And cottage country itself, of course, is way more than just the throngs who drive out of the city whenever it gets hot. There are rural communities right now that are facing a tough problem. Try to keep the cottagers out and protect their precarious supply chains and limited medical resources and lose out on the millions of dollars that keeps their town afloat during the winter. Or open up, welcome the cottagers, hope that they don't get overrun, and maybe their small businesses will survive to a better summer. You'd think that in a situation like this, there would be clear rules and guidelines communicated widely by the government and public health officials. You'd think that with the big cottage weekend less than 1 month away, we'd have an idea of what that weekend might look like. Not so much. And we'll try to give you an idea why that is, once Claire gives us the news.
The federal government has released new modeling that shows that while the number of cases of COVID-19 was once doubling every 3 days, it's now doubling every 16 days. Canada's chief public health officer, Dr. Theresa Tam, says that's an indication that physical distancing has worked and will continue to work if Canadians follow the guidelines. Quebec has released more details about easing restrictions around COVID-19. Some businesses will be allowed to reopen in May. And this is going to happen gradually. Premier François Legault says physical distancing measures will still be enforced. And Quebec, as we know, has been the hardest hit province in the country. But Legault says they are able to move ahead with this plan to reopen the economy because the number of deaths outside of long-term care homes has remained stable. Manitoba is expanding its testing capacity to include anyone who has any symptoms of COVID-19. Premier Brian Pallister made that announcement, saying even if you have a mild symptom like a runny nose, you can be tested. As of Tuesday evening, 50,026 cases of COVID-19 in Canada, with 2,958 deaths.
I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Matt Gurney is a columnist and an editor for the National Post, and he joins us now. Hi, Matt.
Hey.
First of all, before we get into all the really interesting stuff that I wouldn't have expected to come up when you asked this question, tell me how you got on this topic, looking into what's allowed and what's not allowed in terms of visiting cottages.
To be honest, it kind of came out of nowhere in particular. There really wasn't a particular thrust for it. My family does have a cottage. But my wife and I had decided a while ago, for our own reasons, that we haven't ruled out going up, but we've certainly decided we're not in any particular hurry because of all the various things that are going on. But I did hear from a friend that a friend of hers, it was a bit of a broken telephone, that a friend of a friend of a friend had apparently been stopped by an OPP officer and told, "We're not letting you come up. You know, whatever your purpose here is, we're not allowing non-full-time residents access to this area, so turn around and go home." And there was nothing in my knowledge of the rules that would have justified that. So that's kind of what kicked it off. And the more I started to look into it, the more I realized that there hadn't been a lot of clarity from the government. There had, in fact, been conflicting signals from some officials. Some municipalities in cottage country have been saying, stay home. We love you, but stay home. Others have been saying, if you have a property here, you have a right to access it. So I decided just to try and get some answers. And I thought I would just tweet them. Like, I didn't think it would become complicated. I thought it'd be, hey, folks, this is what I found out. Boom, the end. But it actually ended up becoming a much more complicated thing, which is kind of how it ended up going from a tweet to a column, and then it became a second one, and eventually it became a third.
So let's start here, what are right now the official guidelines or rules on city people going to their cottages?
It depends on your jurisdiction, and your mileage will vary for some of the reasons I'll get into in a minute, but the Ontario government has confirmed to me, as did the OPP, the Ontario Provincial Police, that there are no restrictions. If you own a secondary property, you can go. You are being asked not to, but that is just a request. And, you know, you can make of it what you will. Like, the preference by public health officials, and that's been reiterated by the premier, is that they want all of us to avoid any unnecessary travel. They want all of us to stay home, but they have not taken the step of actually making that either a law or an emergency decree. In Quebec, they have. They've gone further. They have basically restricted access to whole parts of the province. They have said that you must reside in your primary residence, and people are being turned back at the Ontario border. If you're an Ontarian who owns a recreational property in Quebec, you're not being allowed to go there. Ontario hasn't gone that far. They have said they would prefer you not do it, but that's not the same thing as saying that you can't.
So why, first of all, are Ontario and Quebec trying to keep people away from their secondary properties?
Well, I mean, that's actually a great question, and I don't know if there's a super easy answer to that. I mean, there is the official answer, which has been given, which is simply to say, look, we don't want people going because we don't want people traveling. And it's a period, full stop. You know, how we're going to fight this is by reducing travel everywhere. Then there's the more detailed answer, which comes down to, in the big cities is where we have our critical supply chains that are the most resilient. And we mean groceries, food in the grocery store, essential medicines and drugs at your local pharmacy, and hospital systems, entire medical facilities where there's more capacity in case you get sick. Not even just with COVID. Like if you bust your leg falling down a flight of stairs, you're going to be seen faster and easier in a big downtown Toronto hospital than you might in a rural one. So those are the official reasons. And you know what? You know, they might make sense. Like I said, your mileage will vary depending on your own specific circumstances. But in the big picture sense, that does make some sense. The problem, though, is that, first of all, circumstances do vary. We have people, for instance, one person I heard from is a pilot. And he's a cargo pilot, and he's still on essential duty. And his cottage is about an hour away from the airport he works out of. And because he's forced to still be at work, he's worried about exposing his family because one of his kids has an immune issue. So his wife and his kids are living in the primary house. He's living at the cottage. Like, that's a great example of where what goes against public health advice is actually probably the right decision to make. So that's an exception. And another issue, though, that just comes up of why people are being encouraged not to, it's not a nice thing to talk about. It's an unpleasant thing. But I think there is just some real animosity at times between seasonal residents of communities and year-round residents. And believe me, in my email, I've definitely heard from both sides of that.
I wanted to ask you about those emails because you've alluded to on Twitter the dozens and dozens of replies you've got. How many would you say are focused on, it's my cottage, it's my right to go here, you know, versus I understand, but I just want clarity? Like, is there anger here? Is there just confusion? Because we're about to enter like peak cottage season, at least in Ontario and Quebec.
Yeah, it's only weeks away. It's close, and if you look out your window, I live in Toronto, and if I look out my window today, well, today is not a great example, but recently, if I look out my window, the weather's good, and it's getting better, and it's getting warmer, and particularly for communities that are really based around like a boating season or the lake or the river or fishing, the ice is melting and moving out, right? So the cottages are pretty much good to go. To answer your question, though, I would kind of... Let's speak in big picture terms here. I would say I'm going to break down the email into a third, a third, a third. One of them is purely, hey, can you provide any clarity, or thank you for providing the clarity that I have. One of them are what you've alluded to, which is people going, I pay property taxes. I fund schools at my cottage that my kids don't go to. I pay for a hospital year round that I might only ever need for 3 months of the year. And if I want to go, I have every right to go. And the last third, I would say, comes from either, this is kind of where I return to kind of the animosity between the groups here. It's either coming from people who are full-time, year-round residents of more rural communities in cottage country who are simply saying, stay home. We don't want you here. We don't want anyone coming up because we're worried about our own survival. But there's also been blended in with that some people who, as far as I can tell, have absolutely no horse in any of these races and are simply, they view anyone who would have a second property as essentially an inherent first world problem. And if they're talking about, oh, I can't get to my cottage. Yeah, well, boo-hoo, I'm living in a 400 square foot apartment. No one cares about your problems. That actually is not necessarily true. There's more secondary residences in Ontario than people might realize. There's almost 900,000 of them. And if you assume an average of two people per secondary residence, you're getting up into the millions of people here. And in fact, some of them are used by big extended families. So there's a considerable number of Ontarians who do spend at least some of their year at a secondary residence. But in these times when there's been a lot of economic dislocation, there's a lot of economic anxiety, and a lot of people have lost their jobs, you won't be surprised to find out that some of the email I'm getting is simply emoting and expressing their own frustration at the idea that people have two houses to begin with.
Well, I mentioned off the top in the intro to this show that there is a sense that like people who own cottages are privileged, but there are also people who have a cottage that's in their family and they rent in Toronto, and they might right now be worried about not being able to pay rent. And all of a sudden that secondary residence becomes a primary residence. And what happens then?
You know what? It's actually interesting, right? Because you're absolutely right. I mean, people hear, the cottage, and they think, you know, it's a palatial lakeside estate in the Muskokas. But what I've really been hearing from as well are a couple of unique categories here. You've already kind of alluded to one of them. People who do keep an apartment in the city, but actually have their primary residence in a more rural area. And because of the pandemic landing in the winter, they were at their secondary city residence and they want to get back to their primary residence. But also, and just in terms of speaking about, you know, the privilege element of this here, a big chunk of these people who have of so-called secondary residences in Ontario are actually snowbirds. And their winter residence might be in Florida or Arizona. The Canadian government told them to come home, and their only secondary resident is in a so-called cottage community. They have nowhere else to live in Canada. So they came home as their government advised them to do, but now we have issues, for instance, where some of the cottage associations that are kind of like condos, right? They're not even turning on the water. They're saying, we're not going to turn on the water and we're not going to permit that to happen. And the other issue that comes up, and I don't know how many this is, like I haven't done a head count on this, but the cottage restrictions have also impacted trailer parks. And a lot of people might have a trailer park or an RV at a part-time seasonal community. I leave it up to the listeners to decide for themselves whether they would consider a trailer park part of privileged living.
How hard has it been to get the kind of clarity we're talking about here on this issue? Once you started asking questions, what happened?
I had to put the hammer down a bit. I had to use my big boy voice, which was unexpected. Like, I had thought that this would be something that was easy to come up with. To give credit where it's due, the municipal politicians, I think, have actually been great. One way or another, they have not hesitated to tell me what they think or to at least send me statements if I've asked, you know, hey Matt, here's a statement we've previously released on the issue. I think the municipal politicians have been good. The Ontario Provincial Police gave me a really thorough and clear answer. They were late on the deadline I had given them, and that complicated one of my afternoons. But hey, I'm not going to complain too much about that. The Ontario government was difficult. There had been a reluctance on their part at first to provide me any information. The answer I got was a very polite but completely pro forma blow off. And that's when I had to reiterate my questions in a somewhat stronger tone, and I got an answer from them on that one. For what it's worth, this is just purely my speculation. I don't think they were trying to be secretive. I just think there's a really bad habit among Canadian government officials of never answering a question if they can find any plausible way to avoid it. But that's probably a conversation for another podcast.
I mean, that was one of my suspicions, is that, you know they can't legally prevent it. So they say, we're strongly requesting it. And then they don't want to get into it, because the more they get into it, the more it becomes clear that it's actually just a suggestion. And then you have people saying, well, okay, then I am going to go. And they obviously don't want that.
Oh, I'm even more cynical than you. I mean, I think it is outright, in some cases, just a force of habit of government comms officials honestly believing it is their job to never answer a question if they can avoid it. I think in this particular case, it's complicated. But as you well know, getting good, timely information from Canadian public officials is never quite as easy as it should be.
I want to ask you also about the inverse of that relationship, because you've been talking to the municipal politicians. There's also kind of a give and take in the economies up there, right? Like, what will happen if everybody does listen to the government and does stay home and there is no summer cottage season up there?
You know, we had talked before about some of the differences in the email, and that is actually a really interesting one. I'm seeing a real divide between kind of year-round full-time residents in cottage country communities whose livelihood is independent entirely from the seasonal tourism, or whose livelihood is dependent on the seasonal tourism. And I haven't actually released this article yet. It's a bit of a spoiler here because I'm working on it right now. But I have interviewed some business owners, and one of them told me, you know, thus far, just looking at last month's numbers, business is off 86% year over year. So how many businesses out there in general can absorb an 86% business loss? The problem is, if we're looking at the trajectory to get Ontario open again, we're looking at the ability to hopefully get the economy working again. No business out there can survive an 86% year-over-year decrease for long, and our roadmap back to a functioning economy is going to be months long at least. It's going to be bad in the cities. It's going to be hard enough there. We know this. But some of these smaller communities where there are fewer other job options, there's fewer other business opportunities, there's fewer opportunities to pivot to other initiatives or to do retraining. If you think it's going to be bad in the city, it could completely destroy the economies of some of these cottage country towns. And I don't really think yet that's something governments have clued into. I think they're maybe starting to realize this. But as bad as the overall hit to the economy is, it's going to land lopsidedly on seasonal businesses.
Well, in the makeup of some of those small towns up there, I mean, in Toronto or even in smaller cities, you can lose two or three coffee shops and a couple of restaurants and a bakery, and there are other options. But up there, if you lose the bakery, that's probably the only bakery in town. And, you know, same for a number of pet food stores or whatever you have.
Yeah, and it's also things like restaurants that in some cases, like we're talking about the plight of restaurants as one of the early canaries in the coal mine because of the immediate economic impact of that. But imagine being a restaurant where you only actually make your money in 4 months of the 12, and maybe you actually shut down for the other 8 months of the year, or you really reduce your staff. I'm talking about also boutique-y industries, things like very niche to a season, boating and fishing, hunting in some areas, water sports and watercraft, things like this that only have a very narrow window because of the weather. I don't know if there's going to be many of them left, say, 16 months from now.
When you talk to the community leaders in the rural areas, what do they want from the provincial government? Do they need a plan that's different from the cities? Do they just need clarity? What would they like to see?
Honestly, I didn't get a ton of feedback on that. I don't want to overstate what they told me. So I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know if I can answer that question. What I can tell you, though, as the issue that came up, even though we didn't often talk with them in a sense of, you know, municipality and provincial government, we didn't really have that conversation. I did get the sense from talking to a lot of them that they are communicating really, really closely with their local OPP. And that's kind of a blended responsibility, right? Because it's a provincial police agency, but it's also responsible for a lot of communities' local policing. So those are issues they're worried about, because it's not only the issue of tensions between full-time and part-time residents, it's also the issue of you have thousands of dwellings loaded with valuables that are currently sitting idle. And that's obviously going to be a temptation for some people. And there have already been some instances of cottages burning down under suspicious circumstances. So the police are definitely worried about that. But in terms of a municipal to a provincial government answer, I didn't really get much of a sense of that.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
One of the things that came up when we were discussing your columns and these stories in general is, what about people who make plans to essentially go up and isolate? So let's say I'm going up for the long weekend. I'm going to buy all my groceries at my grocery store in Toronto or wherever, drive up, not stop, not talk to anybody, and stay there for the weekend. Am I still told I shouldn't do that? Do we think people really will do that, I guess?
You know what? I think that's two separate questions. Will people really do that? Some of them won't. And I think it's a similar question that we have when we talk about opening parks and other public venues like that. A lot of people are going to use them responsibly. Some won't. And we have to make decisions about whether or not we put the hammer down and punish the good to get the bad, or whether or not we accept people being jerks as part of living in a free society. Normally, I think that's a much more cut and dried question. In a public health emergency, it gets more complicated. To your other point, though, I mean, in the abstract, speaking just for my family, our property is fairly isolated. We do have neighbors, but none of them are immediately next door. It would certainly be my intention to bring up all of our own supplies. And we have everything we need on site to be self-sufficient. We could do it in a very, very responsible way, and we would intend to do it that way. Would we be in the majority doing that? I honestly don't know.
Finally, I know you said the provincial government hasn't been very responsive, but do you think over the next few weeks we'll see like a clear outline of what cottage season should look like in Ontario or maybe in Quebec, because they have to provide some sort of guidelines, right? Because we are talking about millions of people that will want to head up as soon as the weather turns.
Yeah. You know what? I think Quebec has already set its position and is going to stick with it. So they've made their decision. In Ontario, it's a little bit more complicated because, as you and I have already said, there is the issue of the economic side of this. These businesses in cottage country who probably, I mean, I don't mean to make this such a weird moral statement, but don't they deserve as much of a chance as any business to find a way to switch to, say, curbside delivery or to reinvent themselves and still service their customers and their clientele as best that they can? Certainly that's the argument that's going to be made. And we have in Ontario a provincial government with pretty considerable rural representation, not only in the caucus, mm-hmm. but also around the cabinet table. So we know that the premier is going to be hearing this. This is absolutely going to be an issue that is on his radar and his agenda. But, you know, there is also the fact that the Ontario government belatedly, but enthusiastically, did get on board with the public health measures. So it's going to be a really interesting tension. My gut feeling is if the government was going to issue an outright decree, they probably would have by now, and it would be difficult for them to do it going forward. But if we do start having a lot of those people behaving very irresponsibly in cottage country communities, and especially if we do start to get a sense that lives genuinely are at stake because of this, well, you know what? Then things can change. We've already seen the Ontario government adapt on the fly so far. They may yet again. And, you know, I'm just looking at my calendar right now. We're going to start finding out in the next 3 weeks or so, because the May 2 4 long weekend, Victoria Day, is not long away.
I was going to say it'll be really interesting to see what the communities and the highways look like then. Thanks, Matt.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Matt Gurney, columnist and editor at The National Post. That was The Big Story. For more big stories, you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. We cover cottages periodically. You can also find us on Twitter, and I'm sure some of you will want to yell at us about this one. We are at TheBigStoryFPN. And of course, we're in your favorite podcast player. You can find us on Apple, on Google, on Stitcher, on Spotify. Doesn't matter, we'll be there. Leave us a rating. Leave us a review, unless you think this episode was too privileged, in which case, skip the review. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.